This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. You can get the latest on how true crime is told and sold in your inbox each weekday for just $5 a month at bestevidence.fyi. And now, our episode.
I was reporting many of these stories for 19 years. But the power of television to make people feel as if they met these women. So many of these people who I'd talked to, and I'd had these experiences, but not all of America had. And now people were hearing these women firsthand tell their story. I think that had an incredibly powerful impact.
Surviving R. Kelly returned to Lifetime over the weekend with The Reckoning, and we as a culture return to the idea that when it comes to the famous, sexual assault is only the first crime to be survived. We'll talk about that, plus singer-songwriter Alison Moore's crime-war of her parents' deaths, Blood, a memoir. When is narrative important for processing, and when is it just picking a scab? These and other questions I'm not halfway qualified to answer in The Bladder Presents, episode 127. Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. Worth everyone's time is my Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs co-host, Mark Blankenship, who is joining me in the guest chair today. Hello, Mark.
Well, hello, hello.
Before we begin, a content warning for, really, the entire episode, which contains references to and discussion of child sexual abuse, domestic violence, and suicide. As always, please listen with care. Let us move to our most wanted section. Surviving R. Kelly Part 2, The Reckoning, which premiered January 2nd on Lifetime. Here's the case file from Lifetime's press page. Quote, the story continues. Following the groundbreaking Emmy-nominated and Critics' Choice Award and MTV Award-winning explosive documentary series seen by over 26.8 million people and sparking worldwide conversation, Lifetime unravels more to the saga with Surviving R. Kelly Part 2, The Reckoning. Featuring interviews from a variety of perspectives, including with new survivors, supporters, psychologists, and cultural and legal experts, and more insights into the ever-growing saga of the R&B singer, who is currently facing federal and state charges. The three-night event uncovers new stories with revealing details and explores why the voices of the girls that spoke up decades ago are only now being heard. End quote. Okay, so we had some screeners of this. I didn't end up watching the entire run of episodes. Mark, how many of these did you watch?
So unlike last year when I watched everything, this year I watched two.
Mm. You and I spoke about it briefly a couple of days ago when we were meeting up for another event. You seemed thumbs downy about it. At that point, do you want to talk a little bit about why that is?
Sure.
Actually,
in the language of the press release, there is, I think, a seed of why I feel uncomfortable with part two. First of all, that it's subtitled The Reckoning, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, yeah, there is a little bit of the inappropriate horror movie sequel.
But there's also something about the way that they have been touting now with more survivors. It's this weird thing. It feels like that this iteration of the project is now tipping over into commerce that benefits Lifetime.
Okay.
Whereas the first iteration felt more to me like Lifetime helping tell a story that needed to be heard.
Right.
And there's something about the shape of the first two episodes, this sort of chaotic structure where it just keeps bouncing around without what I felt was a clear narrative point of view that makes it seem like this was hastily thrown together to make a buck. And the first series was so streamlined and potent and forceful. And in the first two episodes that I watched, you were either getting a rehash of what we'd heard before, same old song about R. Kelly's past told with interviewees who were now hip to how they were going to come across on camera, like his brothers. And so they don't seem like they're telling you the truth in the same way. Or you get these lengthy passages about the importance of the first series. And it just felt like a dog's breakfast of topics that lacked the impact of the first one. Now, that isn't to say that this issue of what R. Kelly has been doing and what the culture has allowed him to do is not important. It is still very important. But now I wonder if the effectiveness, I wonder if this format is now the most effective way to push the conversation even further, even though I think it was exactly the thing that we needed to push it further last year.
Yeah. And as we heard in the opening quote from Jim DeRogatis, who was the guy who was just reporting it tirelessly for like two decades for, I believe, the Sun-Times, there is something about seeing it on TV and having it in front of you, like literally that way, that I think it did move the needle. I am not as down on it as you. I wrote a piece about it for Primetimer last week. We will link to that in the show notes. I feel like part of the mandate of this set of episodes is to look at not just the survivor stories about surviving the Kelly's alleged, I guess we have to say, predations, although whatever, come on. But also having to survive the disbelief, apathy, doxing by fans and supporters and so on. And that is a big part of this systemic failure of women and survivors of sexual abuse, that there's like a second attack. So I think it's worthwhile for that, but I'm not entirely sure. I do agree with you that this is perhaps less effective than the first one, and your point about the brothers is well taken. I'd like to play a clip from Robert Kelly's younger brother, Kerry, talking about abuse that he suffered as a child.
I would make believe that I was somewhere else playing with my friends, or I would say I'm at the park. Doing things the kids supposed to be doing at that age, you know? That was just with me, but then there would be times that she would make Robert stay in the house.
I'm interested to hear if you think, I mean, his older brother Bruce, who like still... is still trying to justify Robert's behavior to like similar, he's going to similar lengths that he did in the first episode. I think you're right on that. He is much more hip to how that's going to play. So he's tweaked his delivery somewhat. Did you feel equally cynical about Kerry?
No, I did not. I really was just the older brother, but Kerry seemed to me to be, again, I don't know. I don't really know these people. It's all being mediated through the screen and the editing, but Kerry came across to me at least as being more authentic in what he was saying and less calculated.
I would agree with that. But there's definitely, I think with Kerry, this, there are, different tracks along which his pain is running. And one of them is empathy, unfortunately, for what his brother suffered, because they all suffered it. But another is guilt about his complicity, or in the, at least in the earlier going, trying to help cover up Robert's crimes. We will get back to that with a clip later. But I think the show, The Reckoning does, I mean, I'm not sure how elegantly it's done, But the clip I'm about to play is talking about the psychology of denial among fans and not supporters, but like among his circle even, but like outside the circle. And I'm interested to hear what you think of how they sort of attacked this problem. So here's clip three.
It can be devastating and disappointing to us to learn something about somebody we care about that is so disconnected with how we see them. What becomes problematic is that instead of sitting with that discomfort, we deny, we don't believe people's accounts, no matter how much evidence is accumulating, because it disagrees with a preset notion that we have created.
White savage liars!
Women lie too!
Women lie too!
Women lie too!
What did you think of this approach?
You mean on behalf of the show's approach or these crazy people with their signs?
The crazy people with the signs can kick rocks. That's how I feel about that. I meant the show's approach. I was wondering how you saw, like, how they chose to talk through this response.
Yeah, I this goes back to the dog's breakfast comment I made before. I found myself wishing that they had spent more time on this topic. And I will acknowledge that maybe they did in the episodes I did not watch. But if I haven't, life is short. If you haven't gotten there in 2 hours, how much am I supposed to like hang out and wait? Sorry, The Wire. I know your fourth season is supposed to be really good, but I didn't have time. Anyway.
You should really watch it. It tells you how to watch it, Mark.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
I mean, it is really good, but it's fucking devastating. So
I watched the entire first season of The Wire and never was interested by it. And I just feel like if I don't like it at the end of the first season, why should I carry on? And I know.
Yeah, no, anyway, it's not going to be for you then.
Yeah. And
that's fine.
As you were talking, I was considering how it is valuable for the show to arrive so quickly because it is able to instantly show us the aftermath of what happened to these people when they spoke out. And I found myself wishing that we were looking even further into this cultural psychology around denial and the abuse of people who are trying to acknowledge what has happened to them. Like the additional abuse, the societal abuse. And that thread, whenever it was picked up, was always very compelling. But I felt like because that thread was one of five or six things that the series seemed to be trying to accomplish, that it never got explored with the depth that the first series was able to explore the simple question of, these women need to tell their story. Like it had one thing. It had a mission, you know, and all of the stuff that we learned in the first series about R. Kelly and his background and all of the stuff we learned about the cultural tendency to overlook the pain of black women, all of that was there, but it was always spiraling off of the central point, which is these women need to tell their stories. And without that sense of clarity and structural focus, all of the things that were interesting felt so scattershot that I guess my long-winded answer to your straightforward question is just it felt scattershot and I wish that it had been more focused.
Having seen the whole thing, I think you're right. Not that it's necessarily possible to silo each of the issues that the second part was trying to address neatly into its own episode. But having watched the whole thing, like, episode three, which was devoted in the main to his to R. Kelly's former hair braider, Lenita, and her difficulties in getting any justice after what he did to her, and her decision to step out from behind the non-disclosure agreement, like. Not that the story wasn't devastating, but there was an aspect to the pacing that felt a little bit not fetishy. Like, I don't want to be unfair to what the producers were trying to do, but it was like these extreme close-ups of the crying just felt a little bit like, I think that in both sets of episodes, our job as viewers is to hear the testimony and believe it. And I think that that's worthwhile. I also think in the clip that we heard just now that they're trying to both explain to people who still don't believe that R. Kelly did all this shit why they might be in denial about him doing all this shit.
Right.
But at the same time, they're speaking to people who do believe the survivors and saying, this is why these protesters that you think are crazy assholes, this is where that response is coming from. So
yeah, that's so well said. It's in the in trying to serve multiple perceived audiences, it's actually doing all of them a disservice.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a pretty ambitious thing, but I mean, one sort of disappointing thing to me is that the project, like the producers may have felt obligated to give not equal time, but like, look, here are these women who used to work for him, who are just going to sit there and like make shitty faces and say about how, you know, they successfully mounted a disinformation campaign on social media.
And be proud of it.
Yeah. So let me play that clip.
The women that I saw in the docuseries were the type of women that Robert would have picked. And you know what they're upset about? Is that they didn't get the limelight until they were on Lifetime television. During my working position with Robert over 8 years, we brought on my sister for about a year.
When the docuseries aired, nobody wanted to listen to me, and unless I said something bad about R. Kelly, because that's the popular thing to do. What worked was for me to go onto social media and use the hashtags, hashtag R. Kelly, hashtag unmute R. Kelly, hashtag R. Kells with the Z. It started a whole movement. It worked. Thank God. It worked. It did. It worked.
I mean, given that he's facing like 210 years in jail, it didn't really work.
And this woman has also mastered that insidious thing of adopting the stance of the rebel outsider in her language and even her inflections. The way that she's like, because nobody would listen to me unless I wanted to do the popular thing.
Yeah, it's like you're not actually along. Like, well, it should have been the popular thing for years. Like,
you're not being an iconoclast when you refuse to acknowledge the truth.
Yeah.
Like, that's just, you're just being an idiot.
And this is one place where I agree with you that they needed to sort of pull apart all the strands of the things that they were trying to do and like organize it a little more just boringly, I guess, and straightforwardly, because this section is highlighting an interesting point, which is like, for a guy like R. Kelly or Weinstein or Woody Allen or whoever,
Michael Jackson, or
there is an industry around this person that, and people who rely on him and his continued success and his continued, you know, not being in prison so that they can eat.
Right.
So that is perhaps not going to, like, admirable behavior is perhaps not going to be incorporated into the workflow, but it's at least an, you know, it's worth talking about and looking at, and they do that. But I also wish that they had spent like just a whole, like half an episode talking to people who work for him who are like, look, I didn't see it, or I did see it and I quit, or something. Like, I just felt like it could have been organized better to shine a brighter light on that part of it.
I wonder too, I have no way of proving this, but I wonder, too, if there was more network influence on how it was supposed to be shaped this time, because there also is this feeling like they have to do a recap of the whole first series for people who didn't see the first series, and so they do a lot of wheel spinning.
Who would be watching this who hadn't watched the first one? That's very bizarre to me,
Do we really need to go through the Aaliyah story again? Like, we know.
Yeah, like, we really do.
We got it. And I just wondered, like...
And there's not going to be any movement on that. Like, she's not here, so...
No. Was the filmmaker being pressured to front-load a lot of things or to shoehorn in a lot of exposition? Also, was the filmmaker under the pressure of having to make in less than a year a sequel to a project that she probably worked on for multiple years?
Yeah, which still is not... Like, she had this... She had the... not misfortune, but like events were ongoing even in the last one. So eventually the production just had to be like, okay, well, there's not really a period to put on this. So I guess an ellipsis and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
And now there's a ton of stuff, but like he's in court like every other day or like on a plane back and forth. Like he's in federal court. He's in county court. There, because now prosecutors, having been pantsed by part one, are not about to let him get away with anything.
Yeah.
Like, you spit out some gum and miss the trash can, $100 fine. Fuck you. See you in court. Like, Jesus.
And to get back to... So, one of the things that I did find that was at least interesting as I watched these first two episodes was that I found myself pondering questions that I... didn't have answers to, and they are worth pondering. One of them being, how can one become so emotionally tied up with a celebrity that one has never met that one will loudly protest that celebrity's innocence or try to shame someone who is negatively who's speaking about them negatively? Like, how could you possibly care enough about R. Kelly to scream that women lie about being sexually abused for years at a time?
Yeah, to like, which is go just such a, at, like, put on shoes and a brassiere and go and make a sign with some oak tag. Like, you can feel however you want about it, but to actually, for it to force you out of your house, that's a lot.
I just don't understand it.
I don't either.
And to so that you can stand up and say what? That you think that sexual assault is probably being overreported.
Well, I think there's also a part of this that we can't necessarily access, which is the defense of a black man.
Right. That is correct. You're absolutely right.
There's
Michael Jackson, O.J. Simpson, R. Kelly. I have felt that the narrative of our distance from this problem has been pretty clearly stated.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that that's part of it. And then you have a whole like secondary cultural / historical problem of like American culture just finding black men's sexuality terrifying to this, like, let's make it a felony degree, and that perhaps being reflected forward onto some people's response to these charges. Like, I still don't get how you go out of the house with your poster with that.
I know.
But it's not for me to get because I'm just some white guy. So, you know, what, like, literally, what do I know? But I think that's part of it, but I think that's not all of it. I think there's also a fear of women speaking up.
Mm-hmm.
That is perhaps more of it.
What's actually making me think about this book I read late last year about the women who were leading the anti-suffragist movement in America, trying to keep women from getting the vote.
Oh, yeah.
And the book is called The Women's Hour, by the way. It's really good. It's about the fight in Tennessee to make Tennessee the last state that would ratify the 19th Amendment. And even though you know obviously how it ends, it's still very exciting to read.
Uh-huh.
And it was fascinating to read the passionate remarks by these women who were saying that women should be politically disenfranchised.
Or like Phyllis Schlafly or TERFs, honestly.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What I mean, Schlafly is like a, I mean, those two things are not really related. Like Schlafly would come to our, to my university campus to give talks about how women should be in the home. And I'm like, but you are not in your home. Like, what is your husband eating right now? Hardee's? Because you're not at home cooking.
Ooh, Hardee's. Nice reference.
Mm, thanks. A little roast beef sandwich. Or is that Arby's?
That's Arby's.
Okay.
Hardee's and Carl's Jr. are the same, depending on where you live in the country.
Okay.
But yeah. It,
that has been like, fast food regionalisms with Mark and Sarah.
But it's just, it is fascinating to consider how we become the pawns of systems that oppress us.
Mm, yeah. Or how even something that is shitty, if it's familiar,
mm-hmm.
people will hold on to it because the fear of the unknown is scarier than...
Yeah, it is tempting sometimes to fight hard to keep the devil you know, to use a cliche.
Well, and that's something that, like, when you look at the flip side of that and the judgment that many of these survivors have faced for not leaving sooner, not speaking up sooner, that the women who are currently, I don't know why I hesitate to use the word imprisoned, but like they're still going to his court appearances and living in his apartment. And he's like, I mean, first of all, guys, he's not coming home. Just, you know, go get a job.
Right.
Really. But I think that there has been a lot of judgment of those women and of their parents and of their families. And it's like, well, if you're accustomed to sex and to like interpersonal relationships being transactional and inappropriate / violent, then if this is familiar to you, that's where you stay, because the alternative is you don't know what an alternative is. So,
and maybe the people that we're talking about with their signs and their protesting are in a larger iteration of that same pattern.
I think it's two sides of the same coin.
Damn it. Does that mean we have to have empathy for everyone? Damn it.
No. I mean, these people with their signs need to shut the fuck up. Like, that's a waste of oak tag. No, I'm not trying to, like, empathize with everyone, but it is interesting, I think, that when the psychologists are in the reckoning, talking in interviews about why some people have this reaction, that it can apply, like, whenever we're sort of, like, judging someone for not like thinking right about this issue, that they're coming at it from two separate directions, but the same reason. So I don't know.
Well, no, and actually I think that does mean that we have to have empathy for the people who are fighting hard to protest for R. Kelly's innocence, even though they don't know him, because they are trapped in the larger systemic cultural problems that allow R. Kelly to thrive, and they don't see that they are keeping something horrible afloat because the liberal trap, because now I'm like, but then yeah. I'm sure that I'm trapped in systems that I can't see, and who am I to, and this is why I often feel so frustrated on behalf of liberal politics, because it's this type of like constant self investigation that it's often seems really arch conservative people don't worry about. They're just like, no, fuck you, you're wrong, I'm right, then let's all go win an election or steal it effectively. So another thing I wanted to bring up, an issue that I felt that got dropped like a grenade and then never really addressed, at least when I was watching it, was this notion that R. Kelly had some sort of dissociative disorder.
Yes.
And I called for a clip from someone talking about that because it just seems like a huge thing to just sort of casually roll through the room.
Yeah, I had another clip that came before that, but it's basically oh, no, that's fine. I think I'm actually going to skip it because, first of all, it's like fairly upsetting. And second of all, but it does illustrate something that I think this second part of the series also does well, which is to explain how sometimes survivors of violent crime, or that those of us who are not psychopaths and predators will try to relate our own normal feelings to whatever the predator is doing.
Right.
Not sort of remembering that it's not possible for a sociopath or someone with a dissociative traumatic disorder to relate to the world. Like they just don't work that way. So, because it was that it was Tiffany Hawkins talking about that. She's like, I'm obviously not enjoying this. Why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, to like for a rapist, like they don't care. Like it's not about you. So to try to understand how a monster thinks is like, well, not like us. That's the problem. Anyway. Not, and if that sounds like I'm victim blaming, that's absolutely not what I mean. I'm just saying that there have been yards and yards of books written about, like, you know, getting inside the mind of a murderer. Like, well, you can get in there, but you're not going to be able to understand anything that's happening because you're a normal person anyway. So, let's play the clip that you called for. Do you remember what this guy's connection was? He was just like a friend or a bodyguard or something?
Yeah, he was just in the entourage.
Oh, okay.
And I confronted Rob about it one day. He and I sat down and he said to me, Jimmy, you know, it wasn't me. You know, he said it was my brother. And he said it was his twin brother. He was so believable that I, in my head, and I'll never forget this, I said to my friend, I was like, yo, you know what? I never actually asked him if he had a twin brother, so maybe he did have a twin brother. And then you start to go back, and I'm like, okay, Jimmy, you were being manipulated because I have this powerful individual that I am revering. And I accepted the fact that something that he said didn't make sense because I don't want it to be real. I don't want this to be happening to you.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, that's everything that we just said. In your layperson's opinion, do you think that, I mean, I'm happy for him to be held responsible. Like he needs to be subtracted from society because he is not able to stop himself. That much is clear. Do you think he has some kind of possibly post-traumatic diagnosable mental illness?
Yes.
Yeah. So do I. But I mean, and I think he knows it too. That's the thing.
Yeah. Or maybe he did. And now he has buried that self-awareness so deep that he can't know it anymore. Who knows? But yeah, there were enough people in this season talking about things he said that indicated he knew he was sick to imply that he was aware, but then it didn't matter.
Yeah, no, it didn't matter. There were also people sort of like practically with a telestrator, like going over the Gail King interview and being like, yeah, that's like a cult debriefing experts and stuff like that. We do have one more clip, which is we began with Carrie and we will end with Carrie Kelly talking about how like his brother like lent him a movie, but he'd forgotten that he like taped something off the TV, which I'm like, you're R. Kelly, just buy the tape, whatever. But he used a tape that he had used to record some of his adventures, with one critical difference to the usual situation. Here's clip 7.
He asked these girls on this tape, you know, how old are you? It's like he was interviewing them. And they was like 13. And these was white girls. That was 13. The system is a different ball game than a black girl that's 13. He'd have been gone.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a part of it, too. And we've mentioned it before, but, you know, if this series, could the second part have been better organized or differently organized? Yes. Should it have probably been shorter? Yes. Did both parts of the series kind of lose tone once they started getting into this, like, cloak and dagger, trying to rescue young women who were still living with him and still, like, basically imprisoned by him? Kind of. Like, you know, I hope they get out and get counseling and that everything turns out okay for them and their families, but narratively, the series wasn't able to cope as well with them. But if both halves of this did nothing else, it, like, said and said again and said again and said again, women of color don't get the same justice.
Yeah. And there's, that is a story, or I guess a statement that needs to be made as many times as possible so that we can become more awake to what, how true it is.
Yeah. This was not as effective and compelling as the first part, but I would recommend watching the whole thing, listeners, because I think that to keep it in the discussion and to keep this story sort of front of mind so that we're not doing this fucking story again in the future is worthwhile. Like, sometimes watching it is not like, well, this was a beautifully crafted narrative. It's like, well, we need to hear this testimony because it should have been heard.
Yeah.
The first 50 times someone tried to give it. So, but Mark's decision to, you know, look at it after 2 episodes and be like, there is a lot of television and I feel like I got what I needed, also legit. So please let us hear from you if you have watched the whole thing or if you bailed on it. That's at Blotter Presents across social media. Got anything else on this one?
Just that it's worth experiencing and encountering season 2 and season 1. And you're going to know pretty quickly if it is or isn't for you, but these issues that we're talking about deserve to have their airing.
Yeah.
And it's worth encountering at least a little bit of it just so you can be conversant in what is happening.
Yeah, agree. And do not follow hashtag Arkells with a Z because fuck that bitch. Okay, moving on to our second most wanted section. Because the book came out, I believe, in 2019, and that's still pretty recent as we're recording this. We're talking about a book by Alison Moore, Shelby Lynn's sister, called Blood, a Memoir. Here's the case file from Amazon's landing page for the book. Quote, Mobile, Alabama, 1986. A 14-year-old girl is awakened by the unmistakable sound of gunfire. On the front lawn, her father has shot and killed her mother before turning the gun on himself. Alison Moore would grow up to be an award-winning musician, with her songs likened to, quote, a southern accent, 8 miles an hour, deliberate, and very dangerous to underestimate, end quote. That's from Rolling Stone, and what a great way to put that. Anyway, that moment, which forever altered her own life and that of her older sister Shelby, has never been far from her thoughts. Now, in her journey to understand the unthinkable, to parse the unknowable, Alison uses her lyrical storytelling powers to lay bare the memories and impressions that make a family and that tear a family apart, end quote. That description is a little less crisp than the book itself. I haven't quite finished it, but Mark mentioned this book to me a couple months ago, I think, when he was reading it. And thought that I would really like it, but he read it. I'm in the middle of listening to it. And I think this is definitely one of those times when, like, often it's six of one. And I always go with the audiobook with books we're talking about on this podcast so that I can actually, you know, pull a clip and I'm not just rambling on. I mean, I'm not only rambling on, there's also audio interest. But it's not like, it's not unpleasant. She, Alison Moore, reads it. And because she sounds like past guest Alison LoHuff often, who has a very musical voice and way of putting things, like it's not unenjoyable. And I don't think the book is bad or anything, but I feel like it, ironically, given that this is a musician, I think the music probably worked better on the page. And that's something that you mentioned the other day. Can you talk a little bit about how the book is like physically done and laid out?
Yeah. So the book is organized into chapters that feel narrative and literal, and then, for lack of a better term, interstitial segments that feel abstract and poetic.
Right.
And it's just clear in the way that the book is, that the typeface is set and the way that the chapters are broken up when you're in the literal mode and when you're in the poetic mode. And it gives the feeling of moving in and out of her ability to confront directly what has been haunting her for her whole life.
Right. There's definitely a section in the middle where it feels like she's rewriting song lyrics, and there's a Sestina-esque repetition of certain lines and ideas. And in fact, like, without having looked at it or written it down, it may in fact be a Sestina, now that I think about it, which, pff, hey, difficulty rating, I see you. But it's not quite as... I just think weirdly, like in the ear, it doesn't work the same way. And there's also, I have to say, there are aspects of the very southernness of their southern life that almost seem like, if you didn't know that this was nonfiction, you'd be like, that's too much. Like, I'm not accustomed to sisters actually calling each other sissy. And so that seems very affected to me, even though I know that it's authentic. But I think your experience of that was not the same.
Correct. I really didn't even bat an eye at that. Just calling your sister sissy, that makes sense to me. I mean, I grew up, no one in my family ever called anybody sissy, but like my grandfather called my grandmother mama because that's what the kids called her. And he called his daughters sister because they were each other's sisters. Like it was a short hop from that to sissy.
Sure.
And I heard that, from people all around me. And, to me, it just, it was noticeable because she never referred to her sister as Shelby one time in the book. But it struck me as a conceit I could easily get on board with.
Well, I've just finished a passage where she's talking about the ways that she gets into the like cone of this topic to write about it. It's almost like a decon procedure. She sort of gets up, she has her coffee, she walks past all the family photographs, and she sits at her desk and sort of tries to enrobe herself in the memories, accurate or not. And I thought that was very well done. And she has a way of writing about memory and childhood that is very direct and unadorned, and she's not like trying to make some larger point. She's describing the experience of doing it. The clip that I'm about to play is from a section where she has ordered her parents' autopsies from... And this is a device of longstanding in memoir of this type, is to go back and forth between the autopsy findings and sort of like literally, or excuse me, figuratively fleshing out the impression of the real person, sort of in a side by side. So let me play that clip.
Toenails are painted with peeling lavender polish. I'd wondered if she'd had her toenails polished. She did. Though I sort of doubt the polish was really lavender, that wouldn't have been a choice she'd have made. The examiner might not have known what to call the color of polish on her toes. I bet it wasn't lavender. Upper extremities. There is a 4.5-inch in greatest dimension contusion on the anterior surface of the left forearm, 2 inches above the hand. There is a penetrating gunshot wound to the left arm, to be described in more detail subsequently. The size of a man's hand, if you measured it across the palm, would probably be around 4 inches. 2 inches above the hand is where one would grab another to exert control.
So what did you think of this device, reading it?
So see, just listening to it, I now am certain that this book is not the same in this format, because I was reading that section, the elegance of her construction was so powerful, and I found this book to be sublime. I mean, it was painful but beautiful, and I loved reading it. And I keep in mind also, I have been a fan of Alison Moore's music for almost 20 years now. So I actually know more since I was in high school. Good God. I've been a fan of her music for a very long time. But in the book, that the interplay between the autopsy and her thinking is just so easy to hear. It's easier to hear the distinctions. Like, Alison Moore is not an actress. Mm-hmm. And I think that what she has written is a script. And
right.
I think that we as readers can create voices for the various characters in the script. But I think that she may have done her work a disservice by reading it, because what I found myself wanting was some dramaturgical intervention there, so that maybe the report is someone else's voice or way.
Or there's an echo effect, something. Yeah,
like there needs to be some sort of dramatization of what's happening on the page. And I think that because they did not simply reading the words is not translating the book. You know, they needed to translate the impact of the typography into an oral setting, and they clearly didn't do it. So what I will say is...
Or they tried it, and it just seemed...
Or it didn't work. Or
too florid. Who knows?
But what I will say is, this is a beautiful book to read, and I'm very glad that I did. And I can see how it maybe actually isn't a great book to listen to.
This is not an uncommon... like effect. Like, some books are actually like better off read. There's one by Janet Reitman called Inside Scientology that the extremely faint and yet unmistakable contempt that the narrator had every time he was obliged to refer to L. Ron Hubbard as LRH, like just the way he would say H. He was just like exhausted by Scientology and all of its stupid little Phillips. There are times when, I mean, it's always a different set of synapses that are taking in the information, but there are times when the reader's own like inner ear, as she's reading, like that she is completing certain phrases and certain, like squaring certain circles in the imagination works better. And
yes,
for someone who works so much in song and metaphor in her life and her work, that probably makes more sense for her to like leave a space for the reader to come in and finish it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like this device that like autopsy and then that this was the person I knew is like, I mean, it is something of a trope in this subgenre, but it was also extremely relatable. Like, my grandfather died when my father was 10. He was my age, which, I mean, is not young, but there was like no seeming reason for his death. So they did do an autopsy. I got it from the Philadelphia Medical Examiner, and I did this same thing trying to figure out who this person was and why he was taken based on like medical language that I don't understand. So even the parts that felt a little clunky to me in my ear were still relatable. But it was like, even the, like, there are a lot of things about it that work in the red version, but even the parts that didn't, I was like, well, I see what you were trying to do.
Right.
The next clip involves, she begins by talking about, I believe, Mark Rothko and his death by suicide, and then is sort of moving on to a larger discussion of how we react to those deaths in clip 9.
He killed himself in a studio in 1970. Who knows why? Who knows why he chose that moment to make his exit? I don't guess it's anyone's business. I can't say that I vehemently disagree with a person taking their life, for everyone owns their own life, don't they? They can do with it what they choose. If someone needs to go, then we should let them go. It isn't easy to swallow the idea that someone you love would voluntarily leave the planet. Our egos don't like to accept that we aren't enough to keep them here. We don't like to accept that they were in so much pain, that that pain was larger than anything else, and we won't ever fully understand why.
This is an extremely rare expression of compassion for people who die of suicide. I feel that it is not, but it's not like emotionally correct, let's say.
Right.
To express the idea that some people just need to go and that we should let them put the world down and go. This is an idea that you almost never hear, and it is so beautifully sympathetically put. Here that for all of my issues with this book as an audiobook, I began like weeping in a lift listening to that, because it was just like, what a compassionate and also sort of brave thing to say, especially when you're talking about your own family and just trying to understand things that you know you can't understand. It's really great.
That's one of the things that comes back so much in this book, so beautifully and powerfully, is her father was a really horrible person
a
lot of the time.
If he weren't dead, I'd kick his ass. The dog,
but she,
I'll kill you.
Oh, God, I know.
Yeah.
But she, and yet she can't stop loving him, and therefore it forces her to have this radical type of empathy.
Yeah.
And then she's able to extend that empathy out to Mark Rothko and other people who have died by suicide. It's remarkable.
It is. I'm going to play one more clip, which comes from her description of one of her father's episodes, which she and her mom and Sissy are like weathering in the utility room off the kitchen.
Oh, yes.
In the segment right after this, she's like, she just has like an adrenaline surge, and she ends up having to, she's like, I have to pee. So her mom gets her a bucket, but then she ends up having to poo also. And they're like just sitting there waiting for her father to finish being in a rage. And there's this like turd in the bucket, which is just one of those things that, like, of course, these moments are never all that poetic. There's always some turd. But one thing that she does extremely well is to go back to different times in her childhood and be able to evoke them differently depending on how old she is, without being like corny or treacly about how little kids are. It's a very fine line to walk. Like when she was talking about praying, praying that her father wouldn't kill her mother, that the way that was done was like, that's a very high tightrope that you're on, and she stays on it. But here's this little snippet.
Mama shuffled us into the kitchen and around the corner. We cowered down on the plywood floor by the pantry and the door that opened into the utility room. There was another door in the utility room that led to the side yard. I fantasize now about her grabbing her purse and keys and getting us out of the house that way, back into the car and to somewhere safe. But that didn't happen. She was probably too scared to even think of it. I don't know when he started threatening to kill her, her parents, and us if she ever left him, but I think it was a running theme.
The use of the verb shuffle is perfect. Like, you can absolutely see her, like, herding her children whose legs are shorter than hers into another room. And there's that radical empathy again, that she goes back and forth with both her parents, feeling like frustrated, disgusted, terribly sad, confused, bereft, and it never feels it, but it always feels logical in the logic of grief. So, yeah. So I think I might just like quit the audiobook and read it. Like, get the book, because
yeah,
I mean, I think I actually like the book a lot, and I like the audiobook, even though, y'all, she really does sound like Al Lohuff to me. Like, certain, like, the pronunciation of vehemently in that clip before was like, that's Al.
Well, I would be fascinated to hear, if you do end up reading the book, what your response to it is, because I loved it so, and I wonder if it will translate for you that way.
I mean, it's really something to say that an audiobook read by the author, who is a singer-songwriter, like, that the pacing is not working, but it kind of isn't. Like, I think in certain narratives, an audiobook lays bare some construction flaws, or like it just doesn't work as well. But and also this, like, it's just hard. Like, this topic is just hard.
And this actually gets into the whole issue that I have always had with audiobooks, which is a thing that's meant to be read is not a thing that's meant to be, like, Some books are written to be read on a page. Not everything is rooted in the oral tradition, and some books have to be.
Are you shading my constant Homerian references? Because I deserve never. It, but geez,
never. But in the same way that when a scholar lays the Odyssey onto a page, the page has to be manipulated to reflect the inherent oral nature of the work.
Yeah.
Audiobooks need to be designed to reflect the printed needs of the narrative. Like, things are created to exist in a place, in a genre, in a style, in a format. And when we translate them from one place to another, we have to do some kind of work. Translation is not only about language, it's about venue, genre, style. Welcome to my TED Talk. Thank you.
No, I agree. I always used to think when I was writing my own poetry, like, people would be like, so I got this from the, you know, second and third lines, and I said, what was the intent? And I'm like, well, that wasn't in there, but if you got that from it, then it was. Like, the poem wasn't finished until someone read it and felt some kind of way about something in it. And our drama teacher in high school used to tell us that about plays all the time, that it's like, it's one thing to read it, but you're not done reading it. You have to see it. So there is a third space that exists between the text, in whatever way we mean that, and the recipient. In that space between them is where the text is completed.
Mm-hmm.
This is a lot of woo that I'm getting into here, but
it's important. Like, the way that we, it's important as both audience members and creators of narrative to always be cognizant of the form the narrative has taken. And you owe it to yourself as an audience member to consider how the story you're ingesting might be different if it were played out in a different format.
Yeah.
And it's just as simple as some movies don't work as musicals and some musicals don't work on film.
Yeah. Well, and as a, like, the whole purpose of this Blotter Presents project is to review true crime properties and make a recommendation. And about this, I would have to say, like, get the physical book and not, like, I would say probably not a Kindle copy or like the your library app. Like, I would get like a paper with covers copy of the book, because listening to it has been, like I said, not unpleasant, not unevocative, certainly, but I think that I am losing, I think that some things fell down into a gap that I would like to retrieve by actually reading it. But yeah, I recommend it. How did you even hear about the book? Was it just from like following her?
No,
as a musician,
I had a conversation in November or late October with a woman who works for a public radio station in LA, and we started following each other on Facebook, and she posted about the book on her Facebook page, and it came up in my feed, and I love Alison Moore's music, so I instantly was excited to see that this book had been published, because as a fan of her music, I knew that this is what had happened with her parents, because she wrote a song about it years ago, but she hid it as it was a hidden track on one of her albums because she didn't want it to necessarily be that overt.
Right.
And I just was really excited by the chance to hear her talk more about this thing and how she had coped with it. And I was not wrong to be excited.
Yeah. And the double meaning of blood, the many meanings of blood here are well chosen. So that's Blood, a Memoir by Alison Moorer. That's two L's in Alison and Moorer. And I'm looking forward to getting that physical book from the library. Thank you for bringing it to us. Speaking of things to look forward to.
In local news today, bees.
Mark, where else can listeners find you and your works and days?
Well, you can find me at a show called The Show Tune Countdown on iHeartRadio Broadway, in which I, every week with a Broadway guest, count down the top 10 musical theater songs in an essential category, and I do mean essential, such as best opening number, best female duet, most inspirational Broadway song, etc. Again, you can just Google the phrase Show Tune Countdown or go to any iHeartRadio app and search for the show, and you will find it there. We have a new one every week.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Oh my gosh, it's always a pleasure.
Oh, thanks. I hope upcoming episodes will also be a pleasure. Piper Weiss is coming back to talk about Love After Lockup and MTV's True Life Crime. After that, I'll be talking about yet another raft of Aaron Hernandez properties. Until then, if you've got a tip for the Blotter Presents, like I said, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and the Gram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, that's bestevidence.fyi. 2,000 paid subscribers means Eve Beatty and I will cover the Theranos trial in person. My guest has been Mark Blankenship, and he's on Twitter at IamBlankenship. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.